This episode is brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768.
This episode is also brought to you by our good friends at Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, they've been a place to grow, connect, and serve. If you're looking for a church to participate with virtually during this COVID-19 lockdown, you can find their streaming services Sundays at 9 a.m. on their website or their Facebook page, and check in with their Facebook page throughout the week for encouragement, service times, and other good news. Visit them at canbyfoursquare.com or search Canby Foursquare on Facebook.
Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. The Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, along with more than a dozen local chambers of commerce, politely asked the governor last week to reconsider her decision grouping Clackamas with its larger Portland metro area neighbors. In her response, Governor Kate Brown, just as politely, said no. Yoking Clackamas to Multnomah County, which has the largest population and number of confirmed cases of COVID-19, would set its phase 2 reopening back at least 3 weeks. Though still not fully meeting all the governor's 7 criteria, commissioners felt Clackamas was ready to enter the second phase and asked the governor to let them move forward. Brown, though, disagreed. She said, "We know you are working hard to address the challenges COVID-19 presents. But Clackamas County has seen a 46% increase in new cases over the last 7 days and has recently experienced the second largest congregate care outbreak in the state." Of course, referring to the Marquee Hope Village Post-Acute Rehab Center in Canby, which has been linked to 104 confirmed cases and 10 deaths as of Sunday. Clackamas County originally became eligible to apply for Phase 2 reopening, which allows larger gatherings and looser restrictions on restaurants, bars, and other businesses, on June 13th, after 21 days in Phase 1. As part of the Tri-County area, it would not be eligible to move into Phase 2 until July 10th, and only if all 3 counties meet the requirements for declining case numbers and other criteria. The Chambers of Commerce, including Canby's, has begged the governor to reverse course on the regional approach to reopening, which they said has further threatened the survival of thousands of already struggling small businesses and working families in Clackamas and Washington counties. "Our communities are financially collapsing under the weight of COVID-19, they said, and they each deserve the opportunity to return to normal as quickly as possible. In her letter, Governor Kate Brown thanked the county for the hard work hospitals, public health officials, and residents have put in to help limit the spread of COVID-19. "The data show that the work you are doing to build capacity for testing, tracing, and isolating new cases will be critical as you prepare to move into Phase 2, hopefully on July 10th, she said. "Thank you for all your hard work and vigilance on behalf of Oregonians." One of the 315 employees at the Canby Fred Meyer store has tested positive for COVID-19, corporate officials confirmed Wednesday. Jeffrey Temple, Fred Meyer's Director of Corporate Affairs, said the store associate has been self-quarantining in accordance with the company's emergency leave guidelines. The store was deep cleaned by a third-party sanitation company on June 19th, he added. At Fred Meyer, our associates are like family, Temple said in an email to the Can Be Now podcast. We are in communication with our associate that has tested positive to assist in their needs. Our thoughts are with them as they recover, and we wish them well. Temple said Fred Meyer, which is owned and operated by Kroger, the nation's largest supermarket retailer, has taken, quote, extensive measures to safeguard their associates, customers, and supply chain, including requiring and providing face masks for all employees, installing plexiglass shields at checkout stands, and applying educational floor decals to aid physical distancing. Store capacity has also been reduced to 35% of normal, and employees are screened for fever and other symptoms before beginning their shifts. The number of confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus have surged in the community of Canby this month, though much of it is due to the large outbreak at the Marquee Hope Village Post-Acute Rehab Center. Whatever the case, Canby's zip code has seen 111 confirmed cases as of Sunday, June 21st, which is the most of any city in Clackamas County. Its infection rate of 48.9 confirmed cases per 10,000 residents is the highest in the county as well. The effort to recall Dan Holliday, a longtime civil servant in his second term as mayor of Oregon City, was formally launched this week with the filing of a signature petition. Meanwhile, the effort has been endorsed by current city commissioners as well as two former mayors of Oregon's first city. Originally under fire for comments he made on social media about race, police killings, and widespread civil unrest over the murder of Minnesotan George Floyd and other incidents, he has since been criticized for attempts to surreptitiously fundraise for an unsanctioned 4th of July fireworks show and for colluding with audio-video technicians to cut short the broadcast of a recent city meeting, thereby denying other commissioners the chance to speak on camera. Allegations of corrupt business dealings and multi-million dollar lawsuits have more recently come to light, says Oregon City resident Adam Morrill, who voted for Holliday during his successful campaign for mayor 2 years ago, but is now serving as campaign manager for the effort to have him recalled. The mayor's dismissive responses to current events have put the spotlight on his past actions in office that have not received the scrutiny they deserve, Morrill said in a press release. When the citizens voiced their concerns, he deliberately limited constructive dialogue between his colleagues and constituents. Morrill was among dozens of Oregon City students, business owners, and other residents who testified for nearly an hour during the most recent Oregon City Commission meeting last Wednesday, saying the mayor's comments and behavior had brought embarrassment to the city and demanding he step down. Other city commissioners explicitly called for his resignation, including Rocky Smith Jr., who said he could no longer be trusted after voting in favor of a resolution pledging support for the governor's stay-home orders, then attempting to raise funds for an event that would have violated them just a few weeks later. "From this day on, we cannot take his word at all," he said. "And are we going to deal with that for 2 more years? Yes, unless the citizens of this town fix it. We're doing our best tonight to deal with it, but this community, students, business owners, leaders in this town, they need to speak up. We're not going to stand for this. We're not going to allow it. We're going to do better. Please resign," he concluded in Holliday's direction before turning his back. The commission ultimately voted to censure Mayor Holliday on two grounds: that his actions, quote, "injured the good name of Oregon City, disturbed its well-being, and hampered its worth," and that he violated Robert's Rules of Order in refusing to recognize commission members who were entitled to speak. Commissioners also voted to launch an outside investigation of Holliday's behavior and alleged misconduct, which the mayor himself said he welcomed. A recall has been openly discussed for weeks and a Facebook group has been gathering steam, but it did not become official until Monday. The effort has 90 days to gather the signatures of at least 2,400 registered voters in Oregon City. Two former mayors, Alice Norris and Doug Neely, endorsed the effort in a June 21st letter to the four city commissioners, calling Holliday's behavior disturbing, rude, degrading, and possibly illegal. Dan Holliday's use of social media to inflame members of the public runs contrary to the expectations of a mayor, said the former mayors, who also criticized Holliday's repeated attempts to circumvent the statewide coronavirus orders. The mayor's position should be to facilitate public dialogue and create an atmosphere where goals and policies can be discussed safely, debated, and formulated through respectful dialogue among the commission members with input from the public and city staff. Holliday's actions run contrary to these expectations. Both Neely and Morris supported the mayor in the past, for, quote, a very short time, they said, because they wanted to believe he had changed. We were wrong, they said. He has not changed, at least for the better. Our community deserves better, especially knowing that he has 3 years left in the term of office. We support your resolution of censure and the citizens' call for his removal from office. Recalls are divisive and sometimes necessary to restore balance and trust within elected leadership, they conclude. This is such a time. The Can Be Now podcast reached out to Holliday for comment, but he did not respond. To see a copy of the former mayor letter, find the story on our website, canbenowpod.com. When Michelle Quinn and Kristen Berkey of Countryside Living stopped by Marquee Hope Village Monday with a cart full of lunch and encouragement for the staff there, it was much more than a gesture of goodwill from one long-term care facility to another. For the Countryside contingent, it was a very real recognition that just a couple of short months ago, they were in a very similar position to what the Marquee Hope Village Post-Acute Rehab Center is now experiencing, as it grapples with the state's largest active outbreak of COVID-19 at a senior care home. Quinn said the two facilities have had a good working relationship for many years, and their hearts, prayers, love, and support would have gone out to the Marquee Hope Village no matter what. But the kinship of having been in the midst of their own COVID-19 outbreak just a few weeks ago has allowed them to empathize in all too real a way with what the rehab center staff are going through. The effects of dealing with a COVID outbreak, emotionally and physically, and trying to protect those you care about at work and at home takes a big toll, she said, one that does not stop when employees hit the clock at the end of the day. Now, you see, they have spouses, children, and parents to protect, she said. Many have caring family and friends calling for updates when they feel like they just don't want to talk about it anymore. They might see comments on social media that are totally wrong or made by people who can't really understand the situation and then feel misunderstood. She admitted that she struggled to put everything into words, particularly the feeling of being caught in a kind of limbo where frontline healthcare staff continue to do all they can to fight the infection but feel largely powerless when time seems to stand still and any hope of returning to normal operations is based on test results, incubation periods, the decisions of the county and the state, and fate. Taking the Marquee Hope Village staff lunch was a gesture to help out and show that they care, Quinn said, but the most important gift were the signs bearing the message, "Heroes Work Here." It was given to them by every staff member at Countryside Living, she explained, who knows exactly what they are going through right now and wants to say, "You are amazing. You are strong. We are with you in heart, and you will get through this." The governor's new mask mandate took effect this week in 7 counties that contain more than 55% of the state's population, including Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington, and Marion. Governor Kate Brown says the mandate follows the guidance of public health officials at the federal, state, and local levels, who say that the use of face masks can play a critical role in helping prevent the spread of COVID-19, primarily by reducing the risk of asymptomatic carriers unknowingly transmitting it to others. "We wear face coverings to protect the doctors and nurses working day and night in hospitals and clinics around the state," Governor Brown said. We wear them to protect kids and cancer treatment and people with compromised immune systems. We wear them to protect the grocery store clerk and the pizza delivery gal. We wear them because we don't want to accidentally kill someone. It's really that simple. Face coverings save lives. Here are a few things you should know about the new mask mandate. First, it applies to most indoor places that are open to the public. The new guidance applies to most businesses, including grocery stores, gyms and fitness studios, pharmacies, public transit agencies, personal service providers like hair and nail salons, restaurants and bars and retail stores, shopping malls and ride-sharing services. In short, it applies to those businesses whose employees have been required to wear masks for over a month. So when in doubt, if you see the staff masked up, it is probably a good bet that the same is expected of you as a customer. In counties that have entered phase two of reopening, which does not yet include Clackamas, the guidance also applies to swimming pools, theaters and entertainment facilities, indoor recreational sports facilities, and other indoor venues. In Clackamas County, we can only dream of the chance to wear a face mask while swimming in a public pool. Maybe Sunday. Those with disabilities or medical issues are exempt, as are children under the age of 12. If you or a loved one has a disability that renders you unable to wear a face covering, including cerebral palsy, autism, or PTSD, or a medical issue that makes it difficult to breathe, you do not have to wear a face covering. Children under 12 are also exempt, though it is still strongly recommended that they wear a mask if they can. Kids under 2, however, should never wear a mask. Now, before those of you who simply don't want to wear a mask decide that claiming a medical exemption is a good way to go, please keep in mind that the Americans with Disabilities Act applies only to Americans with disabilities. The healthy and the able-bodied get zero protection from this particular law. Shocking, I know. Third, face masks are not hard to find. Face coverings deemed acceptable under the governor's new guidelines can be cloth, paper, or disposable, including bandanas and homemade masks. They can be purchased online or in most stores. Under the new guidance, businesses are encouraged to provide disposable ones to customers who do not have them, but they are not required to. Free ones are also widely available if you ask around. In fact, down in Waite Park, you may even find them growing on trees. Just see our story earlier this week on the mask tree. And if all else fails, you can always make your own, even if you don't know how to sew. Number four, wearing a face mask for a short period of time will not hurt a healthy person. We've all seen the memes, you may have even shared one or three. But the simple fact remains, wearing a face covering for a short period of time will not hurt a healthy person. Unpleasant, especially if you wear glasses? Oh, sure. Annoying? Absolutely. But it will not hurt you. Now keep in mind, in the places you will be asked to wear a mask for 10, 20, or maybe even 30 minutes, the staff have to wear them for hours at a time. They are doing it because they care about your health and because it's required of them, and they want to keep their jobs and continue providing for their families. So, how about a little solidarity for those essential workers we were all shouting out our appreciation for just a couple of months ago? And lastly, masks are controversial. Last week, the Can Be Now podcast conducted a Facebook poll gauging local residents' willingness to comply with the new mask requirement. Most of them said it would be no problem. Now, some, in fact, commented that they had already begun wearing a mask in public for several months. But others, a full 25%, said they would rather drive the 30 minutes to Yamhill County, which was not one of the seven counties included in the governor's mandate, than support local businesses here if it meant wearing a mask. Face masks have become an increasingly bitter and often political flashpoint, particularly on social media, but in-person confrontations have not been uncommon. Some of these have turned violent and even deadly. So however you feel about masks, please remember that Canby's businesses and employees are not responsible for these new guidelines. They didn't ask for them to be put in place, and they certainly didn't ask to be the enforcers of them. So in the midst of a serious economic crisis, they need our support more than ever. So, if you can, please continue to give them your business. They'll thank you with a smile, even if you can't see it.
Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows, you know?
No. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah, like DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah, which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers, and they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
Hey friends, me again. Just wanted to jump in real quick to remind you that we here at the Can Be Now podcast rely on your financial support in order to allow us to do this work that we so love. If you're a fan of local journalism, then please consider becoming one of our Can Be Now Plus supporters, someone like Denise Ambrosio, who is the coolest person in the world, or at least one of them, because all of our Can Be Now patron members are so spectacular. So, Denise, if you're listening, thank you so much for your support of the Can Be Now podcast. And if you, good listener, would like to support us in this work and allow us to continue to do this work that we love, please consider becoming one of our supporters on Patreon. You can find more information on our website at canbenowpod.com/plus. Again, Denise, thanks so much. We appreciate you a lot.
I think that I would ask you, Ione, just to start by telling us a little bit about Ace and the circumstances that had him in this facility. I think a lot of people think that the Marquis Post Acute Rehab Center, you know, this facility is a place for, is either hospice or a place for folks that are, you know, near the end of their life. And certainly I think the population is older and can have chronic conditions, but often this is just a temporary transition place. These folks are there to get some care and are expecting to go on to a fuller life.
Yes. Well, what led Ace there was that he was having difficulty getting around as far as, and he was falling and things like that. Actually, his health was pretty darn good, and I would have expected him without this to go on for, you know, at least a few more years. But he was a big man, and he just needed more physical help than I could give. You know, he outweighed me by 150 or more pounds and several inches. And so it got to the point where it was just, and then he did have a catheter, which is no big deal, except that it was one of those things that I couldn't insert, and I was constantly having to, you know, get help with that and so forth. So we put him in just in rehab to see if we could, you know, strengthen his legs and so forth so that he could come back home. But it had reached a point where he was no longer doing that in therapy. So it was one of those mixed things, you know, we could still put him in the car and take him places and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was that, you know, 24 hour, you know, trying to hoist him up out of a chair or in and that sort of thing.
Sure.
But I think as far as his heart and lungs and everything, he was seen by the nurse practitioner 4 times a week, and he was, you know, never ever had any other kind of problems. So.
And you guys actually lived there at Hope Village, is that right?
Yes, we had moved over here into an apartment, and we'd been over in Malala, but we moved over here to an apartment because, frankly, the rent was cheaper and more like what we could afford, because where we were, it just kept going up and up and up.
Yeah.
And here it's kind of rent controlled. They have to keep it within your income. So anyhow, and we were anticipating a full life and everything here.
Yeah.
But it just gradually over time, it got to the point where it was just, and I needed heart surgery. So that made the taking care of him even more difficult.
Right, right.
And so anyhow, that's why he was there in the care facility.
And how long have you had you lived at Hope Village?
Let's see, we're on our second, it'll be 2 years in November.
Okay. So how long had Ace been at the rehab center before COVID?
He had been there just about a year.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about him. I understand, and I've heard from you and other people as well that knew him from church or from the facility, that he was just such a wonderful person to be around, that he made all kinds of friends at the rehab center among the residents and staff.
Oh, yes. He had them wrapped around his little finger. He wanted popcorn. They went right away and went popping popcorn.
Did he like, popcorn? That was his favorite snack.
Yeah, he did. In fact, the social
That's
worker
a man after
there.
My own heart. I got to tell you, I love popcorn too. Yeah.
Yeah. She even went back, came into work after hours in the evening to just sit with him some.
You're talking about Tracy.
Yeah, I'm talking about Tracy, bless her heart.
Yeah.
But and she'd get him to do things. They would just talk. He was a big joker. He just loved to pull punches, you know. And she could give it right back to him.
Yeah.
And they just would go on and on. And we all just were delighted. And she could get him to do silly things that I never would have been able to get him to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I called him a gentle giant. He was a big guy, but he was so wonderfully gentle and empathetic. And he was a minister for 40 years. And
right.
He just took care of people. And, you know, I know on my Facebook page, I'm just astounded by some of the comments from people that, of course, I didn't even know that came in contact with him through the years. And,
Tracy, you forwarded me an email I own from her that she had obviously sent to you, that she, you know, kind of had code names when she would post stories on Facebook and whatnot, because of HIPAA, wouldn't give their real names, obviously, or photos, but Ace's was Sassy Resident, and she said that he never failed to live up to that.
Yeah, that's true. I remember one time we were sitting outside, because I was close here, I could go up every day, and we were sitting outside in the sunshine, and Tracy came out, and she walked by, and she said to him, "Well, how are you today, Ace?" And he said, "Well, don't have any complaints." And she turned on her heel in an instant and said, "That's a first." So they were back and forth like that a lot. And he was, and one thing that, you know, I know Marky's going to get a lot of flack about all of this, and I know people have their complaints. They expect to go over and have a hotel. But he was very, very happy there in a way. I mean, you know, he'd have much preferred to be able to be home and so forth.
Right.
But he did say to me more than once, he said, "I get such loving, tender care here."
Mm.
And He was, you know, as long as he had to be someplace, he felt he was in the best possible. And he felt very fortunate. And being a minister, he was in nursing homes all over the place.
Sure. Hospitals.
Portland hospitals and everything.
Yeah.
So he knew what bad ones were. And he really appreciated it. So.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about his time as a minister. Where did he serve?
Well, he served up in a little town called Duffer, Oregon, outside of the Dalles. And he was there 25 years. And it's a little town of about 500 people, although the church was the largest in it. I don't know. It had a few hundred members. And any Sunday morning, you know, be 125, 150 people, something like that. So it was a good-sized little group. And he was there 25 years, and he had been a farm boy. And so, of course, in that wheat farming community, he just settled right in and was part of them. And if someone needed some extra help with a buck and a bale or two.
Oh, some extra muscle, yeah.
Yeah. And so he was just kind of a real part of the community. There were three other churches in the community, the Catholic, the Methodist, and the Assembly of God. They were smaller, and their ministers kind of came and went. So he was really a minister to the whole community. And when he made, every week he made his nursing home calls and or hospital calls. He went whenever someone was in. But he went to see everybody. He was very non-denominational in his approach to ministry. So yeah. Everybody, you know, just called him Ace. And he'd go sit at the tavern and have coffee with them in the morning. All the local yokels.
Right.
And then when he retired from there after 25 years, he took just a small pastorate over at Ty Valley. It was a little independent church, and he was there 15 years.
Wow.
And but he didn't, it wasn't a full-time ministry, so he still had time to go fishing and do some other things that he wanted to do. But he was also the chaplain for Hospice of the Gorge.
Okay.
For a number of years.
You sent me some photos that were just amazing. A lot of them with children. You said he loved babies. Is that kind of that part of that gentle giant personality?
Yeah, that is. It was always, of course, he and I always stood at the back of the church on Sunday morning at the recessional, and then people would come by as is traditional. But all these babies in arms would stop and rub his bald head. They always wanted to rub his bald head. And back in the day when one could do that, the church was just a block from the school. And, of course, so many of the kids were members of the church. And so they all knew Ace. But his doors were always open. He never, ever, they never locked the church. And the kids would come in after school to see Ace and maybe get a sucker or something. And then before on their way home, and he'd always have a crowd of kids coming after school in to see.
Yeah.
And so, like he said so many times, he was so glad he was a minister when he was, because he said that would be looked at askance these days. Back then, they could crawl up on his lap, or they could, you know, and a lot of Sundays he had kids in his arms and all over him and so forth when, you know, at church and Sunday school and things like that. They just loved him, and he was a man of high, high moral integrity. And, you know, I never, ever in the we would have been married 66 years last Saturday. And in those 66 years, I never saw him angry and take anything out on anybody, ever.
Yeah. How big was he?
He was about 6 foot, 6'1".
Okay.
Weighed about in the early years, about 230 pounds, because he was all muscle.
Yeah.
And about 230 here at the end, I think he was about 250, something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. How did you two meet?
Well, he was in the Korean War. And my neighbor had a gal that was my age, a friend, we were just 18, had met a man, a farmer, and they were going together when Don was called into service. And so, in fact, yeah, they were engaged. And so she said that she'd been to one of his family reunions, and she had met Asa's mother. And Asa's mother said, oh, he gets so lonely in service. Do you know a nice girl who would write to him?
Yeah.
And I was at the university then, in the going to school in the full swing of college.
Yeah.
But they asked me if I would, and I thought, well, sure, that's the least I can do. And so over the course of a year, we corresponded daily eventually. And when he came home from service, we started dating, and we knew very shortly that this was something that we both wanted to make permanent. So a year later, we married.
Was he a pilot?
No, he wasn't. He drove these big boats.
Oh, okay.
For a year, he was in Panama and on the locks and so forth. And then the second year, he drove them up in Newfoundland, Baffin Islands, and around that area through the bergs. All of that.
Yeah.
So he was.
I just asked because of the nickname Ace, but I know it's from his name, Asa. But
mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. His family always called him by both names, or they called him AC Orn. But I abbreviated it to Ace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that kind of stuck with people.
I like Ace. Yeah. Yeah. That's fun. Well, tell us about the more recent, the outbreak and kind of what that experience has been like. Another photo you showed me, which was just amazing. I think it was, you know, even just a couple days before the outbreak was known, where he was just sitting out in the sunshine with a couple of other residents and just enjoying some time together. I imagine that must be painful in hindsight to see, to see that happy moment in light of what's happened.
He loved to sit outside in the sun, and it could allow him to be social. He talked to everybody that came in and out.
Yeah.
And so he would sit out there hours when the weather permitted. And of course, he had his full mind, so they weren't worried about him taking off or doing
right.
anything like that. So they let him just come and go out there as he pleased. They always kept an eye and knew that he was there, but they always knew if they didn't find him in his room or the hall that he was going to be outside.
Right.
So when the virus started, they locked them down, and he was locked down for 2 months. And I think it was very, very close, at least 2 months. And so I didn't get to see him.
The pandemic, not the outbreak here, but you're talking about back in March.
Yes.
Yeah.
That they did the lock-in. So I didn't get to see him, but he had a cell phone and I had a cell phone, so we were able every day to talk once or twice.
Right.
And so that was kind of how we communicated. And he loved me to take him little snacks. So I would pick snacks for him in a paper bag with his name on it, and I would go, there's double doors there, and I could go in the first door, but I couldn't get into the facility, but I could sit it on a chair they had there, wave to the receptionist, and then when I left, she would come out and get it and take it down to him to
yeah.
his room.
Yeah.
And so we did that, and Then they finally decided, with all this reopening, to if you'd wear a mask and stay 6 foot away, you could see them outside. You couldn't go in, but they could come out and you could see them outside. And they had been letting him sit outside, but they had a gatekeeper. You couldn't get close to the grounds at all.
Yeah.
And a time or two, I would drive to a parking lot just so I could wave to him. But then they were letting them have a visitor. This only lasted a part of a week.
Yeah.
I think Monday through Thursday. And but Tracy called me and said, you know, he can go out. He's out, and now you can come if you'll wear a mask and sit 6 feet away. So I did that the 3 days that I was allowed to do it. And one day when I walked up and the three of them were sitting there, I called them the Three Musketeers. They all had their minds and they could visit.
Yeah.
Us. You know, oftentimes that's not true in a care facility. But here they were sitting in a row, which they often did. And so as I was coming up, I thought, I've got to have a picture of this for posterity.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I did, because that's my last picture of him.
Yeah.
And they were happy, and they teased each other, and to he and the one in the middle were conniving. They were saying, now the bus is over there, the marquee bus. How could we go steal that and go for a joyride?
Oh,
you know,
maybe,
just things like that.
Maybe the staff was a little more trusting than they should have been of these rogues.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Well, I think they were safe when they were both in wheelchairs.
Could have been an act.
One
you don't
only
know.
Had one leg.
Yeah.
They never could have climbed up in it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the little boys the young teenage boys were certainly showing,
yeah.
Making a reappearance.
Mm.
But he had a lot of gals in there too that he had a good time with.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go up occasionally and eat lunch with them. And one of the gals, he'd make a remark and she'd slug him on the shoulder, slug him on the arm. And
yeah.
Finally, one of the staff came over and said, are you okay with her hitting you? And he laughed and he said, yeah, I'm asking for it.
Yeah, I deserved it.
So,
self-aware.
So he had, had people there he could have a good time with,
sure.
too. And,
sure.
and but he was very, very much alive. And,
yeah.
To almost the end. In fact, the last, on Sunday, died Tuesday evening, and on Sunday, our grandson came down from Chehalis and brought all four of his children. And they put the kids up to the window one by one so they could say goodbye to Grandpa. And he acknowledged and grinned and knew knew all of them and tried. He was, of course, in an oxygen mask by then, but they held a phone to his ear and then we had the phone outside. So he got to see the entire family that weekend. And
wow.
Our other granddaughters that live here are in Silverton. You know, they went up to the window and all had their time to talk to Grandpa. And then Monday evening before our minister came out, when I had called her and told her the end was here.
Yeah.
And she came out, as did his good buddy Rick Gano, who used to bring him buckets of popcorn. And they went over to the window and had a conversation with him, and Deb said that he even said to her, I'm so glad to see you again.
Yeah.
And so he knew also, I'm sure, that that he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
So, Yeah. Well,
this episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been, even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation. They continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273. When was the last time that you talked to Amayo?
I talked to him on the phone seat night Tuesday. He called me Monday noon.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked for not long. He didn't have, you know, much to say.
Yeah.
But, and of course, the, like I say, he had the oxygen mask, but they kind of lifted it for him so that they could put the phone. He didn't have much to say, but he did say that he was doing fine, he said.
Yeah.
You know, always protecting me, always. Hmm. And I said to him, well, that's good, I'm fine too. He said, are you okay? And I said, I'm fine, Ace, I'm fine. Hmm. And
wow.
So that was really, other than the usual I love yous, that was the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
And that was the last one I had.
It sounds like he had a good perspective on it, probably from his faith and his life experience.
Yeah, he did have. And 6 years ago, I had viral encephalitis, and I was in the hospital in a coma for several days, and he sat outside my door from early morning till late at night. And at least that's what they tell me. I don't know. But that's what they tell me.
Yeah.
And during that time, I had a near-death experience.
Really?
And it is the most incredible thing in the whole world. Hmm. There are no words to describe the love that you walk into.
Hmm.
And so it, for me, it's very much real that he just walked into love. It's like a big universal field that just permeates everything.
Yeah.
And I kept saying in my unconscious state to myself, why would anybody ever be afraid to die?
Yeah.
This is wonderful. And I was very reluctant to come back. It was just so wonderful. And I remember saying to whatever it was, it's more energy than it is form, but it's very real. Yeah. And I just said, you know, I'm in my 80th year. I have to go back, but next time I come, I'm coming across. and so for me, that is my peace.
Yeah.
Of mind. It's, you know, I'm very new thought or new age, and I know that this isn't the end of anything. Mm. So.
Yeah. Well, I so appreciate your courage and your time, Ione, in sharing these personal moments and these wonderful comments from Ace and from the people who loved him, including yourself. But I want to ask you just one more question to share.
Sure.
Because I think that it's something that I think will be, you know, more helpful. It just sort of what it's like to be a family member, to be a loved one from the outside, experiencing what you and many folks, sadly, in our community are experiencing with this outbreak at the facility. Just kind of what that's like. Let people know, because sadly and unfortunately, I think it's going to be happening more and more as hopefully not in our community, maybe, but in other places around the state and nation.
Oh, it is already.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is that like to see that, to see the staff working very hard, doing what they can, but probably a certain sense of just feeling powerless, especially for a family member, feeling powerless to do anything to really help.
Yeah, it is a very powerless feeling. It was comforting to me to go to the window, and there was always a nurse there. My son, and none of us ever went that there wasn't a nurse in there with him. And to me, that was incredible. That kind of care. The powerlessness comes from the fact you want to physically be there holding them, holding their hand, talking to them, maybe hours on end, or just being there.
Right.
And that separation of glass feels almost like an imprisonment.
Yeah.
And I know that he felt that way a bit because, of course, they then closed the doors and didn't let them out. They, you know, brought their food to the rooms and things, which has to be done.
Right.
But in those days when he was positive and still not sick.
Yeah.
We talked about that a lot. And of course, for me, as his wife, I have all the what ifs.
Yeah.
You know, what if I tried harder? Could I have handled him?
Yeah.
What if I didn't have the economic means, but what if I had had the money to be able to hire someone to come in and be here to help?
Yeah.
You know, so you just have all those what ifs and how could it have been different? And did I just deliberately put him in this situation? And so there's the guilt, I think, that sometimes the family goes through that. Or something he couldn't escape. I could lock myself in and be here alone, and I didn't have to worry.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so I think that's one of the things that I've wrestled with are the guilts or the what ifs, or could it have been done differently? And without putting fault on the facility, they were, you know, and even the person who brought it in didn't know.
Right.
And that's just a part of what's the pandemic that's happening now.
Well, Ione, thank you so much for your time and telling us about ACE, for whatever is in store for us for the next journey. I know I think it was one of your nephews or someone who knew him that mm-hmm. was talking about ACE and saying that, you know, God better be ready to laugh because ACE is
right,
coming, right?
Exactly. God would poke. Ace would poke fun at God as much as anything.
Well,
he was equally at home with the governor of Oregon when he shared the podium with him as he was with the disenfranchised that always appeared at the door asking for food. It didn't matter which it was.
I love that.
Were both going to get some of his humor.
I just hope the Almighty was ready for him, and I assume he was. So
I'm sure he's an even match, or she, or it, whatever. Okay, well, thank you. And one closing thought, tell them to wear their damn masks.
We're doing our best.
Okay.
Thanks, Ione.
Thank you. Bye.
And finally, we bring this episode to a close with this edition of Can Be Them, which is brought to you by The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. It is your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, children's books. You get the idea. It's all things books across from the backstop in downtown Canby. It's now reopened for in-store browsing. Can you hear me now? Ah, good. On Can Be Then, this week, we are wrapping up our series on the history of the Can Be Telephone Association, which is much better known today as our local telecommunications provider, DirectLink. It began as the Maxburg Mutual Telephone Company in 1904, but soon became an integral part of the growing community of Canby. In the early 1950s, a man named Howard C. Belton joined the board of directors for the Canby Telephone Association, which was more commonly known as the CTA. Belton, like those who had formed the telephone cooperative a half a century earlier, was a rural farmer managing about 200 acres outside of town. But his ambition stretched far beyond that. To say the dynamo was active in civil service and state politics would be a bit of an understatement. He also served 15 years as a member of the Canby School Board and was president of the Butteville Insurance Company and the State Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. He was a senior Grand Warden of the Masonic Lodge and a past Grand Patron of the Easter Star. He spent 20 years in the legislature, primarily in the state Senate, where he had served as president in 1945 and had held the coveted title of chairman of the Ways and Means Committee for several sessions. During that tumultuous 1945 session, held near the end of World War II, Belton helped play a role, for better or worse, in the development of the Oregon tax system. He was appointed to the State Tax Committee, tasked by then-Governor Earl Snell to present recommendations as to the most attractive, advantageous, and equitable tax system consistently possible for Oregon to devise. Whether or not they accomplished that noble goal will leave up to you to decide, dear listener. Can Be Then is not the place for editorial comments. Belton was president of the Canby Kiwanis Club and Canby Chamber of Commerce. In his spare time, he supervised the operations of a timber stand he owned in Clackamas County. There was even an awful rumor that he slept, but only on rare occasions. Whatever he did as secretary of the Canby Telephone Board, he evidently did it very well, because on January 4, 1960, Governor Mark Hatfield appointed him Oregon State Treasurer, replacing Sig Unander, who had resigned to accept a federal gig on the Maritime Board. Now, 12 years earlier, Belton had sought and won the Republican nomination for state treasurer, but narrowly lost the general election to Democrat Walter J. Pearson by less than a one-point margin. "Oh, Howard Belton is extremely well-known throughout the state," Hatfield said in the Oregonian's front-page story announcing the appointment. "Through his agricultural activities, his insurance business presidency, his lodge work, and his long legislative service. In choosing a state treasurer, it seemed to me taxpayers most want a man who is extensively experienced and basically conservative, tough yet fair-minded when it comes to public money." The announcement came at a State House press conference, a photo of which made the front page, featuring not only Belton but his lovely wife, Mae Brown. A few months later, Belton announced he would run for a full term against a Democratic challenger who had already filed. This is State Representative Shirley Field of Portland. "I feel a deep sense of responsibility to the job," Belton said, "and would like to continue the interest I have in public finance for the past 30 years for the benefit of Oregon and its people." Evidently, the people of Oregon wanted him to continue as well, because they elected him to a four-year term in November of 1960. Not surprisingly, around that same time, Belton realized that he might have a bit too much on his plate, and he asked to step down from his position on the board for the Canby Telephone Company. His resignation was accepted, with John Harms being elected to take his place. At the same meeting, the board agreed to spend $86,000 on a new dial board as a step towards ultimate long-distance direct dial service. We youngsters here at the Can Be Now podcast have no idea what that means, but it sure sounds cool. Can Be telephone manager Rufus Kraxberger anticipated that the new hardware would be installed by April of 1961. On October 3rd, 1962, the infamous Columbus Day storm put 80% of the city's more than 2,000 telephone customers out of service. It took almost a month, but service had been restored for most customers by November 2nd. In 1979, the Canby Telephone Association continued its trailblazing ways, becoming the first company to cut a digital-to-digital toll route in the United States. It was also among the first companies in the Northwest to underground most of its facilities. Finally, Canby Telephone was the first company to successfully join an existing Stromberg XY switch with a Stromberg digital switch. And again, we have no idea what that means. But hey, congratulations. Way to go. Now, 2 years later, the CTA had secured a $3.1 million loan to bring, you guessed it, cable television to Canby. In July of that year, 1971, the FCC granted Canby Telephone a cable television cross-ownership waiver, which prohibited companies from owning a broadcast television station and a cable system in the same market. In 1983, 911 service came to our city, and, more important, okay, maybe not really, the city officially granted a cable TV franchise to Canby Telephone. A subsidiary, CTA Communications, was formed to sell phones, key systems, PBX systems, burglar and fire alarms, card lock systems, and a Radio Shack franchise, which I actually remember those. North Willamette Telecom, or NWT, began cable TV operation the following year. Throughout the 80s and 90s, the co-op established itself as a significant and reliable contributor to a wide variety of community causes. They donated $10,000 to Canby Kids to add lighting to Empey Field and $15,000 to Canby Police to establish a DARE program and another $15,000 for the Canby Swim Center. In 1989, they gave $175,000 to the Canby Rotary to establish a perpetual scholarship fund. They donated an enhanced 911 system to the Canby Fire District and Canby Police and gave thousands to the Chamber, High School, and Library for various projects. In 1996, Canby Telephone Association donated free internet to the Canby Public Library, Canby Adult Center, Clackamas Community College, and the Canby School District. And 10 years later, in keeping with changing times and technologies, the 100-year-old Canby Telephone Association rechristened itself as Canby Telcom, which is the name many know it by in town, even though they officially became DirectLink in 2016. As both Canby Telecom and DirectLink, the co-op has been a leader in establishing a robust fiber optic network for their entire service area, according to a multi-phase plan they developed back in 2014. Their work led them to receive the much-coveted Gimme Fiber Award from the International Fiber Broadband Association. So, Canby Telecom, DirectLink, thank you. We're glad you're in our community. And that does it for this episode of the Can Be Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Joining us once again on the Can Be Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
It's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. Interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So
wow.
We're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, spreading the virus and whatnot. But yeah, everything's still moving along.
Cool. So how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com. But just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right, you as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
The Can Be Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Can Be by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Can Be Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Can Be Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.